Edlumino is a charity established by Cambridge head teacher Rory Fox. The charity was set up to educate children in the migrant refugee camp at Dunkirk. Rory came into 105 Drive to speak to Julian Clover.
Rory, thank you for coming into Cambridge 105. You've got a reputation as being quite tough on discipline. Is that fair?
I'd rather look at it really as about fairness, and what I try to do is make sure that children, parents, staff all get a fair deal. Sometimes that looks like being tough because you've got to make hard decisions, but it is actually about just trying to make sure that everyone is treated in an equal and fair way.
I read in one of the many newspaper articles which has been written about you in recent months that you used to give kids detention for not having their pens and pencils on them. Is that true?
Yeah, let me just explain the context of that. I went to one school where we had about 1,000 children. We were getting through 10,000 pens a month, just giving out pens to children who didn't have pens. It was costing a fortune, incredibly wasteful to the environment. And there's no reason why a child can't carry a pen. So we brought in a rule that you have to carry your pen around the school. Obviously, you've got to have a sanction to make it work, detentions. Within about a month, we were no longer wasting 10,000 pens a month.
Mm. And you've worked in Essex, you've worked in the Isle of Wight, and have gained a reputation, I think, what's been described as a superhead.
Yeah, a kind of media title, isn't it, really, superhead?
We like labels. It kind of works quite well.
It doesn't make any difference to what we're doing on the ground on a day-to-day basis, and it keeps the media happy, so fine.
So then how do you go from being a superhead, going in, sorting out schools, turning them round, to running a school in a refugee camp in Dunkirk?
Yeah, it's quite a contrast. I think it's, again, let me just come back to that word fairness. I looked at the children in Dunkirk and Calais, and I noticed that some of those children have not been in a school for 2 or even 3 years. They've been displaced in Syria. They've spent months walking across Europe, and it's just not fair. And I think it's very easy sometimes to sit back and say somebody should do something about it. But actually, sometimes you just got to roll your sleeves up and get in there.
And you would think, though, that within the camps, we're often told that the educational qualities of the refugees, or there's doctors amongst them, there's lawyers amongst them, presumably there's teachers as well. Do they come and help?
There's two issues there, really. One is that a lot of the refugees are seeing themselves as in transit, so sometimes they're reluctant to commit to initiatives because they say, I might not be here tomorrow, and that's not fair to the children. But another issue is that sometimes refugees are telling us that they're doctors or engineers or teachers. We've got no way of checking that out. And there is a child protection issue when you're working with children. We can't just put any random adult with a child because it might not be safe. So I think we're conscious that we've got to be able to get some kind of evidence of people's past careers before we can just put them with the children.
Now, that's interesting. Obviously, if you're a teacher in the UK, you'll have all these checks done on you automatically. And presumably, if there's somebody who you're taking over who hasn't had these checks done, you can sort that out for them quite easily. But you've got this unknown quantity of the people around the camps.
Yeah, some of the people are telling us that they taught in schools that no longer exist because they've been blown up in airstrikes. There's no paperwork because, again, if you're in the middle of a war zone, how do you get documentation? And actually, it is a real problem to us. We're not quite sure what to do about that. So we're keen to move this forward. And, you know, if any of your listeners have got advice on dealing with these kind of issues, great.
Mm. Describe the classroom for me. What's it like?
I fear classroom is a rather grand title. It's a leaky tent. It's an ex-army tent, one that's been discontinued because it's got holes in it. The seams leak. It's quite large, actually. It's about the size of a normal classroom. The floor is very, very muddy. So we've got old pallets down on the floor. We've got benches that have been made by the refugees themselves, again, from old pallets. And that's pretty much about it, really. And we've stuck a few things on the side of the tent. We have some books and resources, but we have to carry them in and out of the camp with us each day because anything we leave in the tent is liable to get wet and become unusable.
And I'm presuming that the camp around you will be, well, mud? Or what do we have?
Yeah, it's a sea of mud. And actually, ironically, where we are is not that far from the battlefields of the Somme in the First World War, where you hear about the mud being absolutely horrendous. And, you know, in this anniversary year, it's really made us think about it, because we're trudging through this really sticky mud. And sometimes the little children, they actually can't walk in the mud. We have to lift them up and help them because it's so sticky and clinging to their feet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, where are you staying? You staying on the camp or just outside?
No, we stay out of the camp. So we have been using things like Airbnb to get cheap apartments. We set ourselves a budget of something like about €20 a night maximum accommodation cost for a teacher.
And is that, I'm just trying to think, if you were sent away on a teacher training course, what would the overnight allowance be these days?
In England, I think we often think about sort of £60-70 for hotels. Hmm. But the way we're doing it is sometimes it's a sleeping bag on a hard farmhouse floor, because money's precious. We don't want to waste the money. It has to go to the children.
And your team, how have you got them together in the first place? Because this is pretty much term time, and these teachers will have jobs. Mm. They'll be teaching their own classes. So how are you managing to work that?
We've got a combination of people. Some people are part-time teachers. So if you only teach 2 or 3 days a week in England, then you've got days available to come over and teach with us. Some people are retired. Some people are consultants. So again, they kind of work to their own timetable, so they can give us time. One of our teachers, Natalie, has resigned her job. She used to work in London. She's come over now, basically works for us 2 days a week and does supply teaching for the other 3 days to fund it.
Right.
So, range of ways.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So when you put an appeal out, it's one of these things, you know, it's not as simple as saying, we need stuff. You know, what do you need? Do you need stuff? Do you need money? Or do you need people?
We need a little bit of everything, actually, but people are the key thing. And in a school, what makes a good school, in fact, what makes a school, is teachers. We can run a school which is essentially a tent in a muddy field with teachers, because what makes good education is a good relationship between teacher and child.
Mm. But I'm thinking here, though, that the language barrier, you know, you're there, and presumably most of you are English-speaking teachers, and these are people who are coming from all sorts of places and congregating. I know we hear the story that it's quite like that in some Cambridgeshire classrooms with a polyglot of languages. But how do you deal with it? Is that yet another problem to heap on top of the issues there already?
Yeah, it is yet another problem. And what we're finding, though, is that where the children have learnt a second language, inevitably it's English, because English is the second language.
And that is part of the appeal for some of these people who are using Dunkirk as, if you like, that stepping stone in order, they hope, to get across to the UK.
Yeah. What we're also conscious, though, is that we are in France, and actually the children need to be learning French as well. So we've teamed up with some local French teachers, and we're trying to make sure that we teach in English and in French so that the children are learning both languages. We teach mathematics, and actually you can teach that largely without a language. It's using symbols, explaining what the symbols mean. The difficulty for us, though, sometimes is knowing the phrases to get the children to do things like, you know, copy this 10 times. You know, how do you do that in Arabic or Kurdish? And that has given us a few problems.
Sure, it has. And the camp itself, I gather, that's moving. One camp's going to close and another one's going to open. That's a logistical nightmare for everybody concerned.
Yeah, the mayor of Grand Synth, which is the area next to Dunkirk where the camp is very keen to move the camp, because if you see pictures of the camp, it is a muddy mess. It's in a muddy field. The field is entirely unsuitable for a camp. It's sprung up almost by accident. The mayor is moving it to a much better designed area where there'll be proper drainage, less mud and better facilities. That will happen, we think, in about 2 weeks.
Right. It's interesting you say the mayor is moving it. That seems to suggest that there is a certain amount of local support for what you're doing, and almost for the camp being there in the first place, which is not exactly the impression one might get from watching some of the news reports from that part of France.
Yeah, the camp is kind of legally illegal. It's tolerated. It's not encouraged, because obviously there are planning laws in France as there are in England. And I think for listeners, just imagine 2,000 people pitching up Milton Country Park and putting up tents and starting to live there. Obviously, you wouldn't want that to happen. It's not good for the people. It's not good for the residents of the area. And it isn't going to work long term. You know, those people would have to be moved. But with 2,000 people, that's not an easy task. You'd need to prepare somewhere for them.
Mm-hmm. If somebody's listening today, they might be somebody who has a bit of money to spare. They might have some stuff. Or they might be a former teacher, somebody who's still teaching. How do they get in touch with you?
We've got a website, www.edlumino.org. If people go there, they can see that we've got wish list up. We've got examples of the kind of things that we're looking for. And people can just get in contact with us.
Just give us a quick some ideas of the sort of things you might need.
Kurdish and Arabic dictionaries have been going like hotcakes at various points. We currently have a good supply of them. We've had a big donation yesterday. But again, as the children start to learn to read, they like to take them away. And rather than hang on to them, we give them out, they take them away, and they sit in their tents and use them.
Right, which is useful, really, because then they're coming back the next day having learned a few more new words.
Yeah, it's incredibly useful. And I think if you also bear in mind the children are sitting in a camp, they've got nothing to do. It's difficult in the dark because sometimes all they have is a candle available at night, but they literally have nothing to do. And if we're giving out books and the dictionaries to enable them to access them, that's really helpful to them.
Mm. And your home is here in Cambridge. How often are you actually here these days?
I'm trying to spend maximum of 3 to 4 days a week out in France. So back here, 3 to 4 days, depending on how many days I'm out there.
Mm.
And, yeah, sometimes it is a little bit awkward juggling things. But on a plus point, it does mean that I'm able to take stuff out with me, able to take visitors out as well, and sometimes other teachers.
And your family as well, of course, wife and children in Cambridge. Do they go with you sometimes, or are they sort of waiting for you patiently back home?
They have popped out over half term and combined it with a trip to France. And yeah, that's been quite interesting as well. It's very helpful.
Roy, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us. The best of luck. And just remind us of that website address one more time.
www.edlumino.org.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Following on from that interview, Linda and I decided we'd like to try and help Rory and his team. We thought it'd be useful to drive over to Dunkirk and see the situation firsthand. So with a car boot loaded with donations from Cambridge 105 listeners, we set off. We met up with Rory and his colleague Ginny Parry in their staff room, the local McDonald's.
When you arrive here, it's crazy. You said, oh, you park in the garden centre car park. And it is, we're right in the middle of a residential area. There is a garden centre just down the road. People are going about their ordinary daily lives, and yet next to the football stadium there's 3,000 people living in these terrible conditions. What's your take on it? How long is this going to last, or is it a permanent feature, do you think?
I think it can't last very long, because the viewpoint of the local residents when we've spoken to them is that they feel sorry for the people, but they're outraged, really, about the situation. Mm. Because it is, you know, imagine Midsummer Common or something in Cambridge with 3,000 people living on it. It's just not going to work. It's not designed for that. You know, just imagine the sanitation issues, the mess that comes about. It can't go on. And the mayor of the borough has decided to move the camp. So in a week or so, there is a new camp being prepared that people will start moving to. It's a little bit further out from town. It's on the outskirts of the town, between a road and a railway track. So it's a little bit more separated. And MSF, the charity, have installed proper sanitation, electricity, and kind of the infrastructure that makes it a little bit more humane.
Right. We saw as we were driving in, I don't know if this is anything related to it, we saw some like wooden, I was going to say chalets. Mm. With that's the sort of thing they're putting in place, is it?
That's the new camp that you've seen.
Right. See that as we came on the motorway.
2 weeks ago, it was 500 tents, but we've had so many bad winds around here, they keep blowing the tents down. So what they've decided now is to replace them with little wooden huts. So the little wooden huts you saw, are each one represents a tent. So there's about 500 of them down there. And what they're hoping is to move the people from the camp that you've seen now to that camp, which is about a mile away.
Right, and it does look far more fit for purpose, I guess, is the phrase you'd use, isn't it?
There's a lot more infrastructure in place.
Mm. And are the people happy about that? Are they talking about that and, you know, happy to be moving?
I think one of the things to bear in mind is compare it to Calais, where obviously there's well-publicised difficulties. There's a kind of container city, and people are nervous about moving in there. And the reason that they're nervous about it is that they have to give fingerprints and be identified. And again, there's a good reason for that, because in the press there have been stories about terrorists in the camp. So the French government has quite rightly said, well, we need to identify who's in the camp. So, you know, take fingerprints. But the issue there for the refugees is that if they are identified as being in France, then legally they have to take asylum in France.
Right.
So this is the big problem in Calais. Now, what's happening here in Dunkirk is a slightly different approach. The mayor has said, we're not going to ask for any identity. So just move to the camp and we're not going to do fingerprinting, we're not going to do what's happening in Calais. So actually, we're expecting it to be a lot more peaceful, because right. there's no reason, as it were, for refugees to kind of resist or object.
Mm. And life's got to be better than this, surely.
Well, yeah, you know, why would you choose to live in a muddy field when you've got something better that you could move to?
Tell us about the unaccompanied children and things like that. How many are you coming across that or not? No,
we are coming across it, but I think it's quite difficult to get a sense of numbers and exact circumstances, because sometimes in the camp we find a group which we think is a family group, and then there's an unofficial adoption that's happened. You know, so one of the children in the group will not actually belong to that family,
right.
and the parents just happen to be looking after the child, and then you look into that and it becomes an unaccompanied minor. Other instances we find a little bit more obvious, child living on their own in a tent. You know, we go and talk to them and then find unaccompanied minor. And we're talking about earlier the example of child whose father is in England and keeps popping out to see him here, but then has to rush back to England to keep his job going and to do the paperwork to try and get his son across to join him.
And that'd be a teenager, presumably, not a young child.
Yeah, he's 14, is he? Yeah, 14-year-old.
And how about the infrastructure in the camp? I guess it's all being manned and handled by volunteers. It doesn't seem like there's any actual government or agency, you know, official agencies taking part.
I think that's consciously done, because the local state, as soon as the people choose to enter the French asylum system, then the state get involved at that point.
Right.
So I think the perspective is that at this point in time, the people are in the camp because they've almost deliberately chosen not to be part of the French state.
Mm-hmm.
If they make that decision, then the French state engages.
Mm. Let's talk about Ed Lumineau, the charity. So did that get set up as a result of this? Did you come here and think, well, I'm going to see if I can help and build from there? Or how did the charity get founded?
Yeah, basically we came out here and we were interested in what was happening with the children, because when you see stuff on the television all the time, you see all these adults wandering around. We heard rumours of children, we just thought, what is happening? So we came out and that we saw that actually not a lot. And the children that we found at Grand Centre in the Dunkirk camp, before Christmas there was about 300 of them. The numbers are down a little bit now, it's probably closer to 150 or maybe even 100. But still, those children, some of them have been out of education for 3 years. Some of them, you know, 10-year-olds have never started in a school. So we were looking at that and we decided that actually, yeah, we do need to start a charity and do something about it.
So coming back to the Ed Lumineau side of it then, and yours, you had the crowdfunder. That campaign's stopped now on the website. What's the story of that? Because we've got people who want to donate and they don't seem to be able to.
No, there's another one.
Ah,
there's another one.
Ed Lumineau 2.
The way it works is that you have to put it up for a month, for a fixed period. And that month has run its course,
right.
So now there's another one gone up.
Ah,
so.
Great, okay.
And the idea there is that we're trying to really get resources to support people coming over, because you've come over yourself today, and you know it's not a great journey, is it? You've got to cross the channel, you've got to get around in France, and for people that want to contribute, actually, if they come regularly, the costs start to mount up.
But we were doing the maths on you. If you're over once a week, 4 days, you're up in the £400-£500 just for travel.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. So this is partly why we have put out an appeal. We're trying to gather a little bit of money for it. And again, part of the problem is that some of the volunteers that come to the camp, they'll work for a week or two as in a big block, and then they go away again. But when you're teaching, you start to build a relationship with the children. And what works better is, rather than a week or 2 weeks solid and then bye-bye forever, it's better to do a day a week over like 3 or 4 months. But of course, that costs more money in terms of getting teachers out. So we've got this ironic situation that the model that's best for the children is worse for the finances. But what we're trying to do, and this is why we're looking for a little bit of money, is to do what we think is best by the children, even if it ends up costing a little bit more money.
I know your family have been over and have been involved, but I mean, the commitment from you guys must be enormous. Just how much of your life does this take up?
It takes up a few days each week, for sure, doesn't it? Yeah, we're over here Monday to Thursday each week at the moment. And again, as more volunteers come on stream, we're hoping to reduce that a little bit. Fulgence is here Fridays. In fact, you were here the weekend as well, weren't you? So Fulgence is doing 8 days a week, I think, at the moment.
Are you teaching as well, Fulgence?
No, I'm just helping for teaching, you know, and I try to take the French. When they want to learn French, therefore I'm with some volunteers, sometimes I teach French.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll leave Rory and Ginny doing it properly and in a professional way.
I think what Fulgence is trying to do for us as well is to re-engage the local French teacher community.
because again there are quite a lot of schools in this town. There's a lot of people here, and actually if we can get local French volunteers to come in, then that's got to be part of the way forward. And I think Paul Johnson's had a degree of success there. He's got some links with some of the local French schools, and we're looking to build on that and actually get the French teachers more involved, because we want to teach everything that we do in English we need to also do in French, and we're starting to do that. But we want to try and get French teachers teaching French, English teachers English, because it would be daft to do it the other way around. And you know, God forbid we give the children some weird French accent when actually we've got French teachers here who could do it so much better. You know, it'd just be lunacy.
Yeah.
So it's team effort. Our sort of core day, we teach from 12 till 2 and then from 3 till 5. So this is where you've just caught us at the moment. We've done our 12 till 2 slot. Although today, for the first time, we've done something a little bit different. We did a 10 until 12 slot as well. So we've done from 10 until 2, because we're trying to introduce a new slot from 10 until 12 for teenagers in the camp who will come and do extra lessons with us, and then in return, they're our classroom assistants to work with the younger children.
Right, okay.
Because so, the younger children, their language skills are so much less developed. Having the teenagers on hand is really helpful.
And are you with the age groups you've got at the moment, do you tend to by and large treat them as a homogenous lump of kids, because you're actually starting from base on regardless of age? You know what I'm trying to say? Yeah. Their English abilities are the same, their maths abilities are...
No, what we try to do is really tutor rather than teach,
right,
because their needs are all very, very different, regardless of whether it's in English, French or Kurdish and the background. Some have not been in school for 3 years, some were in a school 3 months ago. So, you know, even children of the same age, their education is so disrupted that you just can't put them together and teach them. So yesterday we ended up having 11 volunteers come on and help us. And that was great, because we could split the group down and just each volunteer was working with two children.
Yeah.
Today we've had 6 people here, so we haven't had quite such small groups. But then it's raining, so we get less children when it rains. So it's kind of a little bit random, and it is about starting with each child where they happen to be.
What are you looking to achieve? What's the target for when these kids leave?
I think what we'd really love to see is they're at the kind of age-appropriate point that you'd expect for an English and a French or European child for the age that they're at. That's quite a tall order for some of them, because some of the children are just so far behind.
Yes.
You know, we were talking about a 15-year-old girl. She's never done maths before in her life. So I was showing her yesterday how you do subtraction and addition. Well, normally, someone of that age would have started that like 6 or 7 years earlier. So she's got quite well-developed literature skills, but just never done any maths, because the school she happened to be at out in Syria just didn't teach maths to girls. You know, the girls just don't do maths. So there's a whole kind of unexpected set of stuff we're having to do with her. I thought she'd be at a different point there. So, okay, we start from where she's at, try and get her to where she needs to be.
Mm-hmm. And the volunteers that you were talking about, are they parents in the camp, or are they people from the local area, or what?
It's a bit of a mixture. Mostly English volunteers coming over, but we do have a developing group of French volunteers. We've got a teacher from a local French school who comes in. We've got another couple of local French volunteers who come and help us as well. We've got some parents coming on board, but the Kurdish parents, generally their English skills or French skills are probably less developed than the children. So working with the parents is a little bit difficult, but where we can get interpreters to help us, and that's proving quite useful, because the parents are very good at sitting down with a group of children and getting them to do things like learning how to shape their letters properly.
Yeah.
Because of course, Kurdish children, they're not used to the European alphabet and number system, so having to do quite a lot of work just putting that in place.
And how fluent are you finding you are in Kurdish and other languages? Are you finding you're picking it up?
Ooh. I think we're learning the odd word, but I'm not going to try speaking to the children in Kurdish, because actually it's not a good use of their time,
right,
waiting for me to learn Kurdish. It's what's working for us is using some of the teenage children as interpreters and then giving them private lessons outside, and they actually really enjoy that. It's making them feel responsible and it's really engaging them.
Is it mainly core subjects you're doing, so the English maths type stuff?
Yeah, English, maths, French, science, and a little bit of geography.
Right, okay.
That's all we're doing. Okay. Kind of EVAC.
Sort of, in a very loose sense of the word.
French is something that people often ask us about, the balance between teaching English and French, because, mm-hmm. you know, we are in France. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that everything we teach in English actually also gets taught to the children in French. Because when you're doing things like the alphabet and the number system, actually, they look the same whether you're English or French.
Yeah.
And so that kind of stuff, you can start in either language and then the other language has it automatically. Mm. And we're trying to be sensitive to the fact that children are in France. They may settle in France. But the minute that any of the families decide to settle in France, then the French government take them out of the camp, put them in a hotel, and they go into the French kind of asylum and immigration system. So all the people that we have got have, to some extent, made a conscious decision that they don't want to be in France. So sometimes they're a little bit resistant to learning French. So we use English because it's the second language that the children have got when they've got a language at all. Mm. And then we just try to put a bit of French in, because we tell them that if you're in England, you'd be learning French probably, or another language.
That's true.
You heard Rory mention that the mayor had decided that people moving to the new camp wouldn't need to register. That led to some political tensions, and we had trouble getting into the camp through the main gate. So we snuck in through a hole in the fence and made our way to the school. Once inside, Linda spoke to Ginny about her involvement.
Ginny, how long have you been out here?
I've been out here since October, November time.
That is quite a long time, because it's now, you know, the end of February, March. Well, it's March, actually.
It is, isn't it? 1st of March today. It's, yeah, we've been out here a long time, but it's actually gone so quickly.
What made you come out here? I mean, what put the idea in your head?
Well, Rory and I were over in France. We had the opportunity to visit the Calais camps, so that's what we did. We sort of thought we'd go and have a look.
With no thought to coming
here. We had no plan that in 6 months' time we'd be sat in a windy tent whatsoever. We actually were just going to have a look to see the story behind the news. As soon as we saw it, though, we just knew that we had to come and do something. We could see lots of children that just weren't being educated, and that's what we can do. We can educate children as teachers.
Yeah. So you saw all these kids. There was no school at all at that stage, was there? Was there anything at all?
It was a small nursery school, which had a heater, which is nice. So they were looking after some of the babies, giving a bit of respite, really, for families who need to go and use the showers, look after the children for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. They hadn't got anything like this. They hadn't got a school. They hadn't got somewhere where you could learn English and maths and French. And
so what did you do next, then? You had this idea in your head you were going to come out here and do this. How did you go about it?
So we started off over in Calais, offering our services to a couple of more established centres over there. We're English teachers, so we said, you know, we can come and help you learn English. They're regularly staffed by volunteers, not qualified teachers. So they quite like the idea of having qualified teachers come to teach.
Yeah.
So that's how we started, with a couple of backpacks each, just walking into the camp, with our whiteboards, with our own unique style and sense of humour, see what we can do. That kind of gained a little bit, and then we had, I'm not sure whether it was the opportunity, but the experience of coming over here to Dunkirk, and that was that. We knew we had to do something here.
Because this is 10 times worse.
This is so much worse. This is, we are in, well, you've just experienced it, ankle yeah. deep, knee deep in mud, it, going in
more
over
than
the top
ankle
of our
deep.
Wellies.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got short wellies on, and it was just about lipping over the top of my wellies. That must have been 6 inches, 7, 8 inches of
yeah,
mud.
Yeah, and you're not even here on a bad day.
Thank goodness for that. That's all I can say, because that is shocking out there.
It truly is.
You know, I was saying to Neil yesterday, kind of, it sounds a bit like the First World War in the Somme. You know, it
yeah,
just sounds awful.
I think it's exactly
like
that mud. It is that mud.
Just like trenches.
It is.
Mentality.
It's rotting food outside. It's lots of rubbish.
And rats.
And rats. We did have, actually, in the school, we had a cat for a while. And the cat did a wonderful job. We were calling it the school caretaker, killing the rats for us. So in the morning, Rory would get here and get rid of the rat that had been beheaded. Slightly different kind of school caretaker situation.
That's brilliant. So, okay, so you came out here, you got a tent, presumably, in order to teach in, first of all?
We came out here and we just spoke to some people and said, look, is this something that you were interested in? And they said straight away, yes.
And was this the refugees themselves you were speaking to?
This was the refugees themselves,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we had a family that had opportunity to give us a very small tent. It was probably my measurements aren't that good, but kind of 12 foot by 12 foot. And they put up one of their tents for us and they said, yes, if you could teach us in here, that would be great. So we started like that. We didn't have a floor or anything. It was actually an old scout tent that someone had donated from England.
Oh, yes.
So we started there. Then again, refugees have made us seats. They've made us planks of wood to sit on. So
they've
like
got really involved in helping with this, have they?
They have. Some families have been so generous. I think as much as we want to help, they want their children to be helped as well. They want their children to go to school. It normalises life for them.
Yeah.
I think they like the experience of having us, yes, look after their children for a couple of hours, but yes, help them with their learning and keep their lives as normal as possible.
Yes, I can see that would be really, really important. You know, if you've been educated yourself and you've come from that kind of background, and presumably there's a real mixture here of people and families.
Yeah, there is. There are some children that we meet that have obviously not been to school in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And so we're starting right back at basics. How do you hold a pen? Yeah. So it really is that basic. Before we even move on to letters or numbers and words, it's how do you hold a pen? We've got other children that will quite happily sit here doing maths at the same level that we would see children in England. And doing their simultaneous equations, their quadratic equations, telling us about the past tense, the future tense of different words and checking with us. So there's a real, real mix here. And you can just see there are some children that have come from schools just like you and I, mm-hmm. and that have left their country very, very quickly.
And it must be really traumatic for them. And this is kind of normalising their lives to an extent, isn't it? Because, okay, we walked in here today and it's much better than it was that you've described a moment ago, because yeah. things have kind of grown slightly. The tent is much larger
it
now.
It has, yeah. We've had some really generous people donate lots of items for us. We've had the refugees themselves make sure that we have things like a heater. You know, for the first few months, where it was very, very clear saying, please don't give us a heater. You need the heaters in your tents. Mm-hmm. You need them over the winter particularly. However, lots more people have got heaters now. So we have taken an old oil keg, and we have got a bit of a heater now.
That's fantastic, actually. It's a real contraption, that, isn't it? It's
yeah.
a kind of heater thing. It's a what is it?
It's a heater thing.
It's something with fire in it, and there's a pipe that's going out the side of the tent.
There is.
Brilliant.
But it just about works. It keeps us all that little bit warmer.
Oh, it does.
And we were having to turn children away when they were so cold and so blue, whereas now at least we can warm them up by the fire. Although I'm not recommending that schools in England have fires in the middle of their classroom.
So you've just kind of got established here, and it really is starting to look like a school. And that's brilliant. You've got flooring down, there's pallets on the floor.
Yeah.
There's your little benches around here.
Yeah. Desks and chairs.
Desks and chairs. They came at the weekend, did they?
It was a weekend ago, from a Belgian school. They were refitting their school, so they said, would you like chairs and tables? And we said very greedily, yes, please. And they organised getting them in here. So we came back to school on Monday and there were desks and chairs, whereas previously we were kneeling on the floor, resting our exercise books on the benches.
So suddenly it feels like a proper school.
It does. I mean, I do sometimes have to take a moment and just have a bit of an attitude readjustment. Say, normal school, we're not quite, but it's getting there bit by bit.
You weren't in Scotland in the 60s.
No comment.
So what going forward, there's going to be a move of camp to a new camp.
There
something
is.
That's being put together, and it's going to be huts.
Yep.
Is there going to be a school there, something being built for you?
At the moment, there is a school being built there, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good thing, because I think they recognise, actually, the good work that this has been doing for the local community here. So, yes, there will be a school in the next camp, mm-hmm. as far as we know.
Have you had any input into that at all? Has anyone spoken to you?
We have. We've got a member of our team that's been talking to the architects and just making sure that it's a usable space, that it's not only usable for a school, but then in the evening it's multi-purpose, so they can use it for other things in the evenings.
Oh, that's a really good idea as well. And there is this dilemma here, isn't there, with the authorities, that they don't want to be too helpful because that kind of verifies the situation and they don't really... And this is an unverified situation because of people that shouldn't really be here.
Yeah.
That illegals, if you want to put it that way,
absolutely.
Because they haven't claimed asylum yet, but they could do if they wanted to.
They could do if they wanted to, but lots of them have got families in England, and so they desperately want to come to England. And I think there is also some misinformation, and they have to try and deal with that and make the best choices for them. And all we can do, we can't really recommend anything. We're just teachers. We are here to teach the children.
And you can just imagine this, couldn't you? If somehow or other something awful happened in the UK,
yeah,
and we all had to shunt across Europe somewhere to some foreign land, you can imagine the amount of information and misinformation and rumours and gossip that would be going around. You can just imagine this, actually.
And also, on a very practical level, there are no newspapers, there is no phone signal, there is no Wi-Fi, there are no computers. So all the usual resources that we would have just to find out a basic information or answer to a question, these people did not have access to in the same way.
So what do you want? What, you know, if you had a magic wand and you could put some resources into this overnight, what would you ask for?
Firstly, we need money to be able to keep having teachers come over. If I could ultimately wave a magic wand, though, I would hope that nobody would be here and that everyone would be settled and happy.
Yes.
So in the immediate short term, we need teacher volunteers, people who can help us in the UK just with very basic things like finance and legal and HR help. That would be so useful to us. So anybody who wants to get in touch who doesn't feel that they can come and contribute to our work in France, there's a lot of back office stuff that we do need to do. And again, we have no Wi-Fi, so please do help.
And this is where people in Cambridge could help, actually. There's a whole bunch of professionals in Cambridge.
There is.
Just a little bit of their time would mean a lot to you, wouldn't
Absolutely. It? IT professionals, especially helping us with websites and things like that, would be so helpful to us.
Okay, and they can get in touch with you through the edlumino.org?
Perfectly done, www.edlumino.org.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Ginny, and well done, because this is excellent work you're doing here.
Thank you. Really, thank you for coming
Really
across.
Impressed.
Thankfully, Rory and Ginny are not alone in their work in Dunkirk. Foujon is a French monk who came to Dunkirk to see if he could help.
Tell us your story, because Ginny and Rory have been telling us you're a monk, is that right?
Yes, I'm a monk, definitely a monk, yes. But you know, I'm at disposal now for, I think, 3-4 months to see what's going on here, if I can find any kind of mission with the refugees or something like that.
Where do you start in a situation like this? Because everybody needs help on every angle, don't they? From basic needs through to, you know, somewhere to sleep, to where to go to. Where do you start?
I think, you know, it's quite obvious. You just come to meet people and, you know, just respond to what they ask you for. I mean, you know, it's mainly he has to deal with, you know, food, sometimes with clothes, and mainly for us, because we know we are going through all the tents. They ask for advice, if it's worth going to the new camp, if it's worth going to England, or to stay in France, and things like that. Therefore, we direct them to the right, I mean, you know, association for that. And after that, we take the kids and go to school at the end of the week.
Is there much of a community that forms when the refugees arrive? Is there any of their own people there to greet them and help them?
Not at all. That's a big problem. There's no organization at all in the camp. You know, the French were there for more than 20 years. The refugees were there for a long time, but there were only, I would say, 50 or up to 200 when the tsunami came. You know, the English took over, and just the connection was not done properly. And now, that's the trouble now, because, you know, as we go to the new camp, and the leader of the camp have to be French, therefore, you know, how can we match all the associations? That would be a big difficulty, that's it.
Yeah. And how about the people as well? Will they all have to sort of deal with that head, or will there be like a committee of some...
I'm a bit upset with that, because there's no connection even with the refugee. The refugee, you know, the English are just taking the lead, and, you know, they decide for them, and they just have to follow. It might be interesting to work out what's best for them, you know, maybe to find a leader, I don't know, even for school. Yeah. For school, it would be great for us to have some refugees who want to teach with us. I think we find some of them already.
Yeah, we had some as well.
Yes, it's good. But I mean, you know, I think that have to be worked properly, I think.
Yes, they're going to want to help themselves, presumably, aren't they? In any country, they're going to want to help themselves. That will have their best interests at heart.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it risks, and I'm going to hate to use the word, but it becomes like a ghetto mentality, doesn't it?
I'm not sure about that, because here in Grand Saint, it's more difficult because we don't have that problem in Calais.
Right.
I mean, we deal with, you know, with a smuggler there, and you get the volunteer and the smuggler. Therefore, you know, the refugees doesn't know how to deal with that because they want to go to England, and also they don't trust people to go, to stay in France. You know, they don't know who to ask, and that's a big difficulty. The reason why, you know, it's not a question of ghetto, I think it's a question, you know, of fear. They don't know what to do now. And I think our job, you know, because we deal with the kids, is to make them more and more confident, and little by little they open themselves. And after that, we can advise them the better way. That's it. You know, I don't know what's the best, really, but, you know, we have to work it out.
Okay. And how long will you stay involved in this project? Is this it for you now, do you think? You'll stay and you're going to see this run right through?
We go to the new camp, you know, if the mayor allowed us to do it, you know, and as soon as the school can work properly, we'll see. I might, after that, jump to another mission, I don't know. Because, I mean, you know, for me, I'm more interested with, I would say, a situation where people are more in need.
Right. Is this going to become less of an issue when the weather changes, do you think? When spring comes and it starts to dry out a little bit and the trees get some leaves, are they going to become forgotten?
I'm not sure about that.
No, I was just asking the question. We see these pictures and we see the mud and we see the situation at the moment. But people are very... I think that's one of the reasons, certainly, why I wanted to come. Because you see this on the news all the time, don't you?
What happened in Calais? In Calais, the funding were dropping a lot. And since the riot, the funding are going up again. Right. I think it's just a question of what's going on. This is a question of guilt, I would say.
Mm. Okay.
When people feel guilty, they just give money.
Sure.
I think it's a kind of that, I think.
It is. I just worry because I made that comment because you see so much of it, don't you? You know, around the world, you see. It seems to be a permanent torrent of people suffering. And there will be a day when it will be warmer here, I guess, and the mud will dry up a bit. And I just worry that you might fall off the map a little bit in terms of public awareness. People forget you're here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is there are issues about the fact that we know people will donate to charities and to causes that they emotionally engage with. Mm. And there's always a risk for all charities that you'll become kind of less interest. But I think that's partly about trying to make sure that what you're doing, you look for as many different ways of sustaining it as possible.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're looking into at the moment is whether it's possible to get any EU funding for educating refugee children. Because you would think that with apparently very large amounts of money being set aside to deal with refugee issues, that someone somewhere would assign some money to educate the children. Otherwise, you're generating a problem for the next decade because you'll have hundreds of children with no qualifications and not able to get jobs.
Yeah.
And that's got to be lunacy. So, you know, someone somewhere must have some pots of money available to educate these children.
And would you use Ed Lumino that way, do you think? Can you see that working on other projects in other areas?
Well, I think we're very open to that because one of the surprising things we found is that a lot of teachers are getting in touch with us and saying, can they come and volunteer over here? And it's making them kind of rediscover what they went into teaching for. And we're being asked, could we get involved in other projects? And you know, very happy to look at that. But it is a question of finances, really. Sorry to be crude about it, but you know, if you haven't got the resources, you can't do it.
And one of the things that you said when you came in and saw Julian, and one of the things I know when we were talking about people who could get involved and help, is that legal and financial help as well. Mm-hmm. People with those sorts of expertise?
Yeah, because you think of Cambridge as a community. It's got a lot of professional people there, people with all sorts of skills. And we do sometimes just need a friendly voice, someone we could sit down with, you know, literally have a cup of coffee and say, look, talk us through how HR works on this particular issue, or what would you do with this tax issue? It's people with professional skills, people with expertise, who are just happy to have a conversation with us when we need some help.
We hope that this podcast has shed some light on the complicated situation in northern France. Linda and I plan to visit the new camp once it's open and to report on the continuing work of the Ed Lumino team. If you feel you may be able to help, the contact details are on the Ed Lumino website, www.edlumino.org, or you can contact Cambridge 105 and we'll put you in touch.
Community Radio in your city.